is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And on this day in history, the Medal of Honor was created on July 12, 1862, signed into law by Abraham Lincoln. And it's based upon a U.S. Navy Medal of Valor, which was created earlier by Congress in December of 1861. And by 1863, the Medal of Honor was made a permanent military decoration available to all members of all of the armed services. And some interesting facts and figures about the Medal of Honor before we get into some of the just remarkable stories throughout history that we're about to cover. And one is this: there have been 3,496 men and one woman who have received the Medal of Honor for heroic actions in U.S. military conflict. That's a total of 3,497 out of the millions upon millions who served. So this is one heck of an honor. And you can't lobby for it, folks. You can't try and get this award. Good luck. And the woman, by the way, was Mary Edwards Walker, a military surgeon who got it for heroism at the Battle of Bull Run in the Civil War. There are 76 living Medal of Honor recipients. And since the beginning of World War II, over 60% of the medals have been awarded posthumously. More than half. And that's pretty remarkable. That's what you've got to do to get this award. Risk your life or possibly die. And so let's get to some of the remarkable stories that we're about to tell. Let's listen to the official citation being read aloud at the White House presentation ceremony describing the incredible acts of heroism performed by a then U.S. Army specialist, Salvatore Sal Ginta, in the war in Afghanistan, the first living recipient of the Medal of Honor since the Vietnam War.
Specialist Salvatore A. Ginta distinguished himself conspicuously by gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty in action with an armed enemy in the Korangal Valley, Afghanistan, on October 25th, 2007. While conducting a patrol as team leader with Company B, 2nd Battalion Airborne, 503rd Infantry Regiment, Specialist Ginta and his team were navigating through harsh terrain when they were ambushed by a well-armed and well-coordinated insurgent force. While under heavy enemy fire, Specialist Ginta immediately sprinted towards cover and engaged the enemy. Seeing that his squad leader had fallen and believing that he had been injured, Specialist Ginta exposed himself to withering enemy fire and raced towards his squad leader, helped him to cover, and administered medical aid. While administering first aid, enemy fire struck Specialist Ginta's body armor and his secondary weapon. Without regard to the ongoing fire, Specialist Ginta engaged the enemy before prepping and throwing grenades, using the explosions for cover in order to conceal his position. Attempting to reach additional wounded fellow soldiers who were separated from the squad, Specialist Ginta and his team encountered a barrage of enemy fire that forced them to the ground. The team continued forward, and upon reaching the wounded soldiers, Specialist Ginta realized that another soldier was still separated from the element. Specialist Ginta then advanced forward on his own initiative. As he crested the top of a hill, he observed two insurgents carrying away an American soldier. He immediately engaged the enemy, killing one and wounding the other. Upon reaching the wounded soldier, he began to provide medical aid as his squad caught up and provided security. Specialist Ginta's unwavering courage, selflessness, and decisive leadership while under extreme enemy fire were integral to his platoon's ability to defeat an enemy ambush and recover a fellow American soldier from the enemy. Specialist Salvatore A. Ginta's extraordinary heroism and selflessness above and beyond the call of duty are in keeping with the highest traditions of military service and reflect great credit upon himself, Company B, 2nd Battalion Airborne, 503rd Infantry Regiment, and the United States Army.
Unbelievable. And in this interview with David Letterman in 2011, Staff Sergeant Salvatore Sal Ginta is asked what made him go above and beyond the call of duty. Let's take a listen.
None of it is me. I think training plays a big role in it because we train how we fight. This wasn't the first time we've been shot at. It was the most intense fire we've taken from the closest area. But everything we do in the military, you don't do it for yourself. You do it to the person to the left of you, to the person to the right of you. And as long as you have them on your left and right, you're not going to fail them because they won't fail you. And whatever has to happen will happen because we're going to do it together.
So why does someone sign up for a job so dangerous? Here is Staff Sergeant Junta responding to David Letterman asking that question. And Salvatore Sal's answer, well, it may surprise you.
I was working at Ellis Golf Course, and I was also working at Subway. Mm-hmm. And I really had no plan on going into the military.
Right.
I was mopping the floor one night after Subway closed, and I heard a radio commercial come on about, you know, come and see the recruiters and get a free T-shirt.
Right.
I wear a T-shirt, so I'll take it for T-shirt. I'm a sucker about free stuff.
Yeah.
So... So I went down to see the recruiter in Lindale Mall to pick up my free T-shirt. And of course, you know, they give you the spiel. And part of what the recruiter told me was he just kind of laid it out for me right then and there. He's like, hey, we're a country at war. We're at war in Afghanistan. We're at war in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I'm sitting there listening to him. There's parachutes hanging from the ceiling, and like everyone looks all sharp in their uniform. I'm like, okay, you know, he told me a little more, and I took the free T-shirt and I left. And probably within the next 10 days, things just kind of slowly sunk in. Like, I'm 18 years old. I'm a male. I can jump out of planes and they're going to pay me money. I can run around and shoot guns. They're going to pay me money. And for sure, I'm going to get a chance to see the world. Mm-hmm. So I told my parents and I went and signed up.
Still have the T-shirt?
I got tons of them now because they're what we do PT in every morning. Yeah.
I got tons of them now. And what a story. And by the way, what humility. And these are the people who serve, and these are the people who end up being heroes. Working at a Subway, he goes, I need a free T-shirt. And then look what happens. This is Our American Stories. What a story. And we're talking about the Medal of Honor. On this day in history, the Medal of Honor was created on July 12, 1862.
A young man getting over his crazy days, like a bandit getting over his lawless ways. I don't have to do that anymore. I'm like a soldier getting over the war.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. On this day in history, Medal of Honor was created on July 12, 1862. We're ripping through some great Medal of Honor stories. And next, we're going to listen to Army Medic Specialist 4th Class Alfred Rascone, recalling the events that led him to be awarded the Medal of Honor for distinguishing himself and risking his own life beyond the call of duty in the Long Khan province, South Vietnam.
I remember getting up to the front, and I remember the platoon sergeant, Jacob R. Cook, telling me, Doc, stay where you are. Don't move. You're going to get your shot. He said, okay. And I took off and went forward anyway. Twice or three times I tried getting up. I tried getting to him, and every time I was taken down from the gunfire, I just couldn't do it. I don't know what possessed me to do it again, but I literally got up, got in between his legs, and as I'm laying there, he's getting hit. And I'm not being touched. I have no idea what's going on around him. I'm trying to get my hands to him where I could come back and see what's wrong with him. And what I ended up doing, literally, I ended up putting my body, and I turned it around, and I'm facing him then, and I've got my back to a machine gun. And I got hit, and apparently hit me in the hip, went up my spine and came out of my collarbone. And I dragged Thompson off the trail. And immediately I heard somebody else yelling, I'm out of ammo, I'm out of ammo. I came up to him and found out he was shot in the leg. I'm trying to take care of his leg. He's telling me, God damn it, Doc, stay the hell away from me. I kept on saying, you're shot in the leg. Doc, stay the hell away from me, and he ended up using a very nice four-letter word to tell me more distinct as to what to say. I kept on telling him, you're shot. Well, what I ended up doing, I ended up ripping his pant leg open, and I think I patched up his leg. In the meantime, he's telling me, I need ammo, I'm running out of ammo. And apparently this intense conversation goes on, and I'm telling him, oh yeah, I just took Thompson off the trail. He's got ammo. And I'm thinking Gibson's gonna go get the ammo. He says, Doc, we'll get the ammo. Well, being as dumb as I am, I went after the ammo. I went after Thompson. Thompson was dead. There's nothing I could do for him. I took two bandoliers that he had on his person. I went back and gave them to Gibson. And as I turned around, a hand grenade went off at some distance. Then another hand grenade went off and it took off my face, or I thought it was my face. What happened? I got hit from here to here. It ripped literally my face. I think it took a couple of inches off the back of my neck and the forehead and the nose. My life had stopped at that moment. I'm already shot in the hip. I can't move around that much. But when I was hit in the face, everything went literally to a slow motion. I didn't want to play anymore. I didn't want to take care of anybody, but then I had to come back and put myself together again, gather my composure. As I'm laying there, I happened to look up the trail. All of a sudden, I realized that the M60 machine gun, the spare barrel, and I don't know, 200 or 400 rounds of ammunition are still laying on the trail. And the trail is probably no further than 10 yards away from the North Vietnamese. And you can hear them jabbering, and you can hear the whistles going off. And I don't know why, I just went back and I decided I'm gonna go back and grab the M60 machine gun. Got back on the trail, grabbed them, took them off the trail, never got touched. Then immediately there's another hand grenade that goes over my head. And I saw this individual trying to get up. He was shot in the back. And as I got to him, I threw myself on him. I thought the hand grenades were gonna harm him. I didn't realize the fact that, hey, listen, that's a pretty stupid thing to do because you're the one's gonna get nailed. Well, I did get nailed. The hand grenades went off and, yeah, as Neil says, I saved his life.
And as we learn at the Medal of Honor Society website, and that's cmohs.org, when another grenade landed near a wounded sergeant, Russ Goen used his own body once again to shield another soldier. It was only when he began to lose consciousness that he was removed to a field hospital. Next up, Dakota Meyer. And here's the citation being read aloud at a White House presentation ceremony for U.S. Marine Corps Sergeant Dakota Meyer's feat of heroism in 2009. At the time, Meyer was a corporal.
The President of the United States, in the name of the Congress, takes pleasure in presenting the Medal of Honor to Corporal Dakota L. Meyer, United States Marine Corps, for conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty while serving with Marine Embedded Training Team 28, Regional Corps Advisory Command 37, in Konar Province, Afghanistan, on 8 September 2009. Corporal Meyer maintained security at a patrol rally point while other members of his team moved on foot with two platoons of Afghan National Army and Border Police into the village of Ganjigal for a pre-dawn meeting with village elders. Moving into the village, the patrol was ambushed by more than 50 enemy fighters, firing rocket-propelled grenades, mortars, machine guns from fortified positions on the slopes above. Hearing over the radio that four U.S. team members were cut off, Corporal Meyer seized the initiative. With a fellow Marine driving, Corporal Meyer took the exposed gunner's position in a gun truck as they drove down the steeply terraced terrain in a daring attempt to disrupt the enemy attack and locate the trapped U.S. team. Disregarding intense enemy fire, now concentrated on their lone vehicle, Corporal Meyer killed a number of enemy fighters with the mounted machine guns and his rifle, some at near point-blank range, as he and his driver made three solo trips into the ambush area. During the first two trips, he and his driver evacuated 24 Afghan soldiers, many of whom were wounded. When one machine gun became inoperable, he directed the return to the rally point to switch to another gun truck for a third trip into the ambush area, where his accurate fire directly supported the remaining U.S. personnel and Afghan soldiers fighting their way out of the ambush. Despite a shrapnel wound to his arm, Corporal Meyer made two more trips into the ambush area in a third gun truck, accompanied by four other Afghan vehicles, to recover more wounded Afghan soldiers and search for the missing U.S. team members. Still under heavy enemy fire, he dismounted the vehicle on the fifth trip and moved on foot to locate and recover the bodies of his team members. Corporal Meyer's daring initiative and bold fighting spirit throughout the six-hour battle significantly disrupted the enemy's attack and inspired the members of the command force to fight on. His unwavering courage and steadfast devotion to his U.S. and Afghan comrades in the face of almost certain death reflected great credit upon himself and upheld the highest traditions of the Marine Corps and the United States Naval Service.
And here is David Letterman interviewing Sergeant Dakota Meyer about finding out he had been awarded our nation's highest Valor Medal in 2011.
So you get the call. Who calls you about the Medal of Honor?
Well, you know, it's been going on for 2 years, back and forth. Just, you know, it'll peak up, people will talk about it, and then it goes away. And, you know, then finally we were like, oh, it's getting more serious because they assigned someone to start talking to me about it, the planning. And then I get a call on a Friday, and I'm on the lake. I was wakeboarding, and they said the president will call you at 11:50 on Monday. Mm-hmm. And they're like, listen, now you need to have, you need to be on a landline, be there an hour prior. You know how the Marine Corps is. And I said, well, there's no way that's going to happen because I got to work. So I said, we're going to have to get him to call my cell phone, and I'll try to arrange my lunch break around that.
Oh, shoot. I'll see if I can't squeeze that Medal of Honor phone call in around lunch. Yeah. And who did you talk to once that happened?
Well, so I'm sitting at this gas station waiting, you know, in this, I'm in this gas station. I'm all dirty. I've been greasing the Bobcat. And
wait a minute. Is that a... Stop it. And you're on the phone with somebody. Who are you on the phone with?
Some woman called, and she's like, you know, let me say they were late.
They were late. Yeah.
So some woman called, and then we were talking about it, and you know, they're like, the president's here. He wants to talk to you. So then I'm talking to him, and he's just, you know, congratulating me, telling me he signed off on it, read about it, and said he'd be looking forward to meeting me. And that was it.
How did that feel? You're talking to the President of the United States.
It was impressive. But, you know, he's a great guy, but I have work to get done.
And this tells you everything about this great country, by the way. It's impressive, but I got work to do. And what a voice. And it's the voice of the American soldier you're hearing, folks. Two of the greats, but they wouldn't say that. They just wouldn't. Listen to the humility in both of these guys. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Story. This Day in History is always brought to us by Hillsdale College. And on this day in history, the Medal of Honor, created on July 12, 1862. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we're closing out our This Day in History segment. Today, the Medal of Honor was created on July 12, 1862. It is conferred upon those who have distinguished themselves in actual combat at risk of life beyond the call of duty, and there have been, to date, 3,497 winners. Or honorees, I must say. I don't know that you can win this. You can be honored. And one woman, by the way, Mary Edwards Walker, a military surgeon who went above and beyond the call of duty in the Civil War at a little battle called the Battle of Bull Run. And now to our last story. And it's Corporal Herschel Williams, and it's World War II. They're willing to listen to him describe his actions on the island of Iwo Jima in the Pacific campaign of World War II. The textbook way to defend an island against amphibious assault would be to concentrate forces and fight the beach. But the Japanese commander had another idea. He wanted attrition. The Japanese prepared a defense that spread pillboxes, tunnels, and concealed heavy weapons all over the island, forcing the U.S. Marines to fight for inch by bloody inch. The Japanese weren't trying to win. They were trying to make conquering Iwo Jima so costly that we would hesitate to invade the Japanese home islands. This was the trap that Corporal Herschel Williams and his special weapon walked into.
So the pillboxes had us stalled. And as we were trying to get across that airfield, we were losing Marines very rapidly. And sometimes, even commanding officers get desperate. So, losing men rapidly, he asked me if I thought I could do anything about those pillboxes that were out there. Somebody in my unit said, I'll try. Now, maybe I did say that. Sounds like me, you know, but I don't know whether I said that or not. But anyway, he assigned me some 4 rifle people, and they were to give me protection while I was out there trying to knock out some of those pillboxes. I hadn't been out there very long, and as I have said many, many times, it's almost like a dream, like it's really not real. 2 of those men, the automatic riflemen, of course, were like me. They were good targets. If a guy is shooting with an automatic weapon, the enemy would like to get him first. In the early part of the 4 hours that I was trying to do this job, I lost him. But the other 2 guys, they kept working with me, and one of them particularly, he kept pretty close to me to try to keep the Japanese off of me. And one of those pillboxes I'd been trying to reach, I saw where they had been firing their weapons. They didn't have any smokeless ammunition. Ours wasn't total, but it was better than theirs. So smoke was curling up out of the top of it, and I sort of figured they had a breathing hole up there or something. You know. So I crawled around to the side where they couldn't see me because one side of the pillbox was solid, and got up on top. And they had a air vent pipe up there, and it was just the right size that my flamethrower nozzle fit down in it. So I was ready to fire. And they knew that, I guess, because they came charging out of that pillbox. I don't know, 4 or 5 of them. I don't know. A bunch, anyway, with their weapons and bayonets to get me. And I got them first. I was just reading recently where flamethrower goes all the way back to the Roman Empire. They didn't work quite as like ours, but they had them. And they were just as vicious then as they are, or were then. Its effectiveness was that once it hit the target, it burned all the oxygen out of the air, lungs collapsed, and people were gone. It was a terrible, terrible weapon. Don't ask me how I did it. I don't know how I did it. But in 4 hours, I knocked out 7 of those things. Much of it I don't remember. And I attribute that to fear. Absolutely. Once you got in behind the pillboxes, well, then we had the advantage. So in getting those 7 pillboxes out of the way, that, according to my citation, opened the lane that enabled us to go on through. When I received the Medal of Honor, the day after President Truman presented it, I went in the office of the Commandant of the United States Marine Corps. And I can't tell you which place I was more frightened, standing before the President or facing the Commandant of the Marine Corps. Because he was almost God in the Marine Corps. He was also a Medal of Honor recipient from Guadalcanal. So he knew what we were facing. But he said to me, as I stood there, very sternly, that medal does not belong to you. He said it belongs to all the Marines who did not get to come home. And don't ever do anything that would tarnish that medal. The medal represents what the country has always stood for. Sacrifice. The day I was born, on October the 2nd, 1923, I was handed a gem that is absolutely impossible to buy. That was my freedom. Can't pay for it. There's not enough money in the world. So this medal, to me, stands for sacrifice and service.
And by the way, that's thanks to the Congressional Medal of Honor Society, CMHOS.org. Listen to all the great stories there. And that's a humbling story to listen to. And how many times, by the way, have we heard this from heroes? You remember that great line at the end of Band of Brothers. Granddad, were you a hero? And he says, no, but I served with heroes. And that was Major Dick Winters, the real man later in his life. That was so great about Band of Brothers. Those flashback scenes to the real life men. What a great idea Spielberg had. And then back to the actors playing them. Made the whole thing. And just a few things about the Medal of Honor. Though not legally required, tradition is for uniformed military to render salutes to recipients of the Medal of Honor, regardless of rank. This is one of the few times that a living serviceman will receive salutes from someone of higher rank. It's fantastic. Of all the wars, it was the Civil War that conferred the most of these honors. 1,523 recipients. But this, of course, was the war of ours that had the most casualties. Theodore Roosevelt is the only U.S. president to have received the Medal of Honor, which he was awarded posthumously for the Spanish-American War service. His son, Theodore Jr., also received the Medal of Honor. Wow. This is Lee Habib on this day in history. We're celebrating and honoring the Medal of Honor itself. It was born on this day in history. And you're hearing the music from Band of Brothers. And indeed, when it even comes up, anybody with a heart has to start to think, gotta rush to the TV and watch this, because it is just so good. We'll do an hour on Major Dick Winters, by the way. His life is as stirring as any I'd come to know when I've studied a lot of soldiers' lives. This is Our American Stories. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and This Day in History to capture this and all of our storytelling about our country. More after these messages.
Yeah.
American Stories, and you're listening to The Tramps and Disco Inferno. And if you were around in the mid-70s or late 70s, you couldn't go anywhere without hearing this without hearing Staying Alive. Disco ruled. And disco was fun to dance to, and it still is. But for some music lovers, oh, disco just was the death of music. And so you had this raging war in the cultures. The rock people hated disco. The disco people, oh, they hated rockers. And there was a line. And if you lived in certain cities, there could almost be violence over this line. It was so crazy. And today we're doing a story about, well, something pretty interesting and something slightly different than our really sublime Medal of Honor storytelling. We like to do the wacky, and we're talking about something that happened on this day in history in the year 1979 that dealt disco a fatal blow. We just found out earlier that Alexander Hamilton was delivered a fatal blow, a bullet from Aaron Burr. He died the next day. And joining us to talk about this historic day that almost killed disco, Todd Stump, who was in Chicago at the time and remembers the experience. Todd, thanks as always for joining us.
Well, thank you. And I have to say, you know, Alexander Hamilton almost got a bullet. I almost got decapitated by that very record that you opened with. The Tramps album from they were on Atlantic. It came flying off the upper deck at Comiskey Park, caught a gust of wind and came back and smashed just over my head. And I still have it.
Well, we're gonna get to how that could have happened, and that is a great way to tease a story. A man was almost killed by a disco record, and I wasn't kidding when I said people were fighting over this stuff. So, Todd, before telling us about the near-death experience you had, set the scene for our listeners. What was going on with disco in America at this time that led to this really remarkable day in history, which we're about to tell people?
Well, you know, the first thing to remember is, you know, today it's typical that someone might have a Taylor Swift song in their catalog along with something by Metallica or something. But, you know, 1979, I don't think you could find anybody's record collection that would include both Ted Nugent and Donna Summer.
No.
When you went to a record store, you had $5 in your hand, and you had to pick a side. You had to pick a team. And once you invested in that team, and say it was an Allman Brothers record, you really invested emotionally with that as well. You wanted to validate your decision, and you took on a lot of kind of the trappings of that decision in terms of the way you dressed and how you acted and what you liked and what you didn't. Today, when music is free, people don't have that kind of investment, and it's neither a good thing nor a bad thing, but they value music less, and they're not as attached to it as people were back in 1990.
No, that is so true. If you were around from the 60s to even the 90s, you defined yourself by the things you didn't listen to. I mean, it was, who do I hate? So there were guys who hated the Beatles, and there were guys who hated the Stones, and there weren't a lot of people who loved both, not many. And then there was the hard rock, the heavy metal rock. There were the Springsteens and the Seegers right in the middle with Tom Petty. Then there were the folkies, there were the Jackson Brown types, and you picked a poison. But people who had the Clash in their record collection did not have Donna Summer. You are so dead right about this. So take us to July 12, 1979, this day in history. What on earth happened? And at all places, a baseball stadium. Talk about this.
Well, that was, you know, 1979. It was about 18 months after Saturday Night Fever was released, and disco was still ubiquitous. The big record of that summer, I think, was Do You Think I'm Sexy by Rod Stewart.
Yeah, Rod Stewart had gone disco, if you remember. Mr. Rock and Roll, Faces, Ron Wood, lead guitarist, and this guy's doing Do You Think I'm Sexy to a disco beat.
Well, it was really painful for rock guys because it was one of their own. He was a Benedict Arnold of rock.
That's right.
So that was all over the place. About the same time, a local disc jockey by the name of Steve Dahl was fired from his radio station when they changed formats and they went to disco. So he did a little parody record called Do You Think I'm Disco? And he would play it, and he would also play disco tunes during his show on his new radio station. And about halfway through, he'd always kind of blow it up. He'd play an explosion sound, and he'd be blowing up whatever the disco record of that day was. Well, they decided to have a promotion at Comiskey Park for the White Sox. It was then owned by the great baseball impresario of Bill Vack, and his son Mike Vack was in the promotions department. And they decided to have a disco demolition night, and they would blow up records in between the games of a doubleheader against the Detroit Tigers. My brothers and I got in early because we used to, you know, it was a different time. But I have two older brothers. We were 13, 14, 15, and we'd go there before the game and fill the cigarette vending machines for a friend of my old man's, and get in early and be able to kind of get the run of the place.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And, well, we were the first of about 70,000 people to show up at 35th and Shields.
And by the way, just to give that a context, 70,000 people showed up. But how many people normally showed up without this promotion? I mean, this is not exactly a baseball team with a wicked winning tradition at the time, Todd.
That's right. It was about, I'd say, average attendance was probably about 15 or 20,000. So they did about 50,000 more than they had they would on a normal night, and they were completely ill prepared.
Exactly, and these people, let's just say, if they're coming to blow up a disco record, you got a very different kind of crowd than you normally have for a baseball game.
There weren't a lot of people scoring the game that.
No, no scorecards. So tell me what happens next. You know, you're there. I mean, we heard this harrowing tale of you almost getting decapitated by this disc. Tell us what happened.
It's gotten more harrowing with age, I assure you.
I'm sure.
The thing was, if you brought a disco record with you, you could hand it in at the gate and get in for only 98 cents. Because it was 97.9, the loop, the radio station. There were so many people, they just couldn't cope. They were understaffed, so people were just jumping the turnstile, holding onto the records. And, you know, it kind of occurs to me now is, where were all these disco records coming from?
Right, right. It's so true.
I think it was this sort of like an altar call for sinners to come and hand in their records. But or did they have to go buy them? I don't know. I got in before the gates opened, so I didn't have to donate one. But people held on to them, and they were just playing frisbees with them all during the games. And then between the two games, the local DJ came out, had a big cache of disco records in center field, and exploded them.
Oh, the place had to go nuts. Did the place just go crazy?
It did. Well, it was crazy to begin with. Then it got completely out of order. People got on the stormed the field, and they could not get them off. Now, Harry Carey back then, Harry Carey and Jimmy Pearsall, two famous broadcasters, did the Sox games at that time, and they begged for people to get off the field, and there were. They got into the center field, into the bullpen, and pulled out the batting cage and pulled out everything, and they're starting fires on there. My brother, who was a much braver soul than I, went out into the field, and he and his buddies were running the bases. Everybody was out there running the bases and sliding into home. And he saw one guy who had cut a piece of sod out and fashioned a poncho out of sod. With a knife, and you know, it was only years later that my brother said, "You know what? It just occurred to me is that guy showed up to a baseball game with a knife big enough to
cut sod."
He didn't know he was going to be on the field that night. He just happened to always have a knife with him, and I'm sure he was not alone amongst the crowd that night too.
We love these stories, and by the way, we're talking about the sellout crowd. There was a raucous overflow crowd. Of as many or nearly 40,000 people outside on Shields Avenue wishing they could be in there.
That's right. I think the capacity of Comiskey at that time was about 50. So there were another 20 to 40 outside. For sure.
Oh, that's just so beautiful. And
well,
so
the strange thing about it, too, was, we were all kids. There was no parental supervision going on that night. So. It was a different time.
Ah, the good old days. As you say here, at the age of 13, you could go to a game without your parents. Oh, my goodness, don't we wish we could have the good old days. Todd, thanks for this great story on your near-death experience at Comiskey Park. And we're celebrating this day in history, the day disco nearly died in Chicago. Todd Stump, join us more often with great stories like this.
Take care.
You got it. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And in the same day, you get to hear two great stories, one pretty darn serious and one damn silly. More Our American Stories after these messages. Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And today, our This Day in History segment honors the life and death of Alexander Hamilton, who died on this day in history on July 12, 1804, the day before he had been shot in a duel with Aaron Burr in Weehawken, New Jersey. And you're going to hear from Ron Chernow, who wrote what is certainly the definitive biography of Alexander Hamilton, and the book that inspired, as you'll come to learn, the play on Broadway that is just sweeping, actually, the nation. You cannot get a ticket. Try as you may. I had some friends fly up around Christmas time, and I had urged them to see the play, and he ended up having to pay $400 a seat in order to see it. And he did, and he told me he was glad he did. And now I'm helping him pay off the balance to a loan shark. It's worth the price of admission, folks. Get the play. And it's not, this is the kind of play, I saw it way back when it was being workshopped at the Public Theater. And it's the kind of play that is not contingent on a star. In fact, it is the kind of play that will make stars. And it is an unlikely cast, it's unlikely music, and it's stunning. And it tells you that the founding father's vision is alive and well, and that it touched a young writer of the caliber of the playwright of Hamilton all those years later, and that that book did, is a remarkable story. And Hamilton's was a remarkable story indeed. He was an immigrant to the United States, one of the seven foreign-born signers of the Constitution, something we don't often hear about. He was aide to camp to then General George Washington, the nation's first Treasury Secretary, the founder of the Federalist Party, our nation's financial system, the United States Coast Guard, and the New York Post. Not bad for one life. Hamilton was a prolific author, including 51 of the 85 essays that formed the Federalist Papers. And he is one of only three non-presidents to have his face on American currency. Sacagawea on the $1 coin, Hamilton on the $10 bill, and Ben Franklin on the $100. In 2004, author Ron Chernow published the definitive biography of his life titled Alexander Hamilton. And on this day that Hamilton was born, we take you to select portions of a talk Chernow gave about his book to the New York Historical Society. Chernow started things out, like all good stories, at the beginning of Alexander Hamilton's life.
He was an illegitimate boy born on the British island of Nevis, and as Dick Gilder indicated, he had suffered through a series of childhood traumas that would have shattered a lesser figure. Again, to reiterate, his father abandons the family when Alexander is 11, mother dies of tropical fever when he's 13, he's then farmed out to a first cousin who commits suicide years later. Calamities of biblical proportions seem to find their way to this young man.
I had a friend of mine once describe how Alexander Hamilton's childhood, thus, he had more sad stories than the Old Testament. And he did. And as Chernow described, my goodness, father abandons family at 11, mother dies of tropical fever at 13, farmed out to a first cousin who commits suicide. You can't make this stuff up. It's so bad. Despite the traumas, he's a precocious young man.
In 1772, in other words, about a year before the Boston Tea Party, a monster hurricane lashes St. Croix, and this self-taught prodigy sits down and he pens a description of the hurricane of such precocious force and eloquence that the local merchants, recognizing this wonder in their midst, band together to finance his education in North America. The Wunderkind studied at King's College in Lower Manhattan, later renamed Columbia, King's being a slightly awkward and inconvenient name after the Revolution. And already as undergraduate extraordinaire, Hamilton is publishing stirring pamphlets against the British. He takes up a musket and he drills with his fellow students in nearby St. Paul's Churchyard, today adjacent to Ground Zero, and he delivers spellbinding speeches to large crowds on what is today New York City Hall Park.
So you're getting to know just a little bit about the nature and character of this young man and overcoming obstacles, overcoming status, overcoming regional differences. This young man thrives in what is Upper Manhattan. Hamilton's Strange Studies? Take a listen.
Hamilton also totes along six volumes of Plutarch's Lives, and he takes the empty pages of a military paybook, and we see him recording notes on foreign exchange, population growth, geography, even European rivers that he will never set eyes on. In fact, in his notes, very interesting notes culled from Plutarch, we see a young man who seems absolutely bewitched by the bizarre sexual practices of ancient Rome. For instance, Hamilton noted that in ancient Rome, young married women seemed to enjoy being whipped by lusty young noblemen. Why? Because they thought that it aided conception. I can tell you, when you study our founding fathers, you are led down all sorts of unexpected byways.
So true. And what's so wonderful about Chernoff's storytelling is that he humanizes the human. And anyone who gets through American history courses and finds them boring, it's not the history that's boring, folks. It's your teacher. It's your teacher. And regrettably, too many history teachers kill this otherwise unbelievable material. Plutarch. I mean, he's studying Plutarch. He's studying foreign exchanges. Who studies both of those things, let alone one? A kid who finds himself at Columbia University. It's pretty unbelievable. And when we come back, more of this unbelievable story. You'll hear more from Ron Chernow. And of course, as always, our This Days in History, brought to you by and brought to us by the great folks at Hillsdale College. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, the life and the death of Alexander Hamilton, who died today on July 12th in 1804, shot in Weehawken, New Jersey, not far from where I was born, on a cliff abutting the Hudson River and overlooking, in one of the most spectacular fashions, the city of New York. And Hamilton was shot there by Burr and was ferried across and died at a friend's home in Greenwich Village. The bullet that Burr had fired to his chest had nestled near his spine, and in the end, Hamilton was paralyzed and died soon thereafter. And what's remarkable about these series, and always they're brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to study history, to learn about history, and if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale comes to you through their great courses online, and you can catch them at hillsdale.edu. And what we learned about history always is that things didn't have to happen the way they happened, and that the men living then, as David McCullough pointed out, talking about the lives of our founders, men back then and now, none of us know we're living in history. We're living in the present. So think about what it might be like. Think about what it must have been like to be alive then. Think about what challenges these guys faced, who they were fighting, what they were putting together. We take all this stuff for granted, folks. None of it was here. And it wasn't there. Well, we're joined for the hour by Ron Chernow, who wrote the Alexander Hamilton biography entitled Alexander Hamilton. Pretty smart to just keep it simple. Chernow let the life story do the talking, and nobody is a better writer. Get this book. You can't put it down. The playwright couldn't. That's how these things happen. He was laying off vacationing, had just finished some kind of hip-hop musical, and who would have thought some kid would have connected with Hamilton and then turned that into a hip-hop musical, his life story. Why, by the way, all the characters, or most of them, many of them, the key ones, played by African-Americans. So this play, they play with race, with history, with time, with everything. It's wonderful. And Ron Chernow gave this talk back in 2004 to the New York Historical Society, and that's where we're going to bring you back to. And we love to do that here at Our American Stories. So let's talk about where we left off. And here's what Chernow had to say about how Hamilton is not too often portrayed.
Now, you'll hear it said, and very often it's taught this way in school, that Hamilton was a ferocious snob, that he was the stooge of the plutocrats of his day. In fact, a would-be despot with Napoleonic ambitions. And, of course, in this particular morality play of early American history, Thomas Jefferson is always represented as the pure and virtuous tribune of the people. Now, in the book, I don't entirely stand the stereotype on its head, but I do try to argue both for Hamiltonians and even, dare I say, Jeffersonians, that the situation was far more complicated than that historical cartoon. Case in point, during the Revolutionary War, it is Hamilton, of course, who champions an audacious plan to emancipate any slave who is willing to pick up a musket for the Continental cause. In the mid-1780s, it is Hamilton who co-founds the first abolitionist society in New York, the New York Manumission Society. In fact, the records, the minutes of those meetings are actually upstairs in this very building where I did an enormous amount of research for the book. Remember that trading firm in St. Croix that I had mentioned that Hamilton worked for as a teenager? That firm had imported up to 300 slaves per year from Western Africa, and it's clear from subsequent actions that this firsthand experience of slavery left Hamilton with a permanent detestation of the system. In fact, Caribbean slavery was the most brutal in the world. Even those who managed to survive the Middle Passage, their life expectancy once they started working in the sugarcane breaks of the West Indies was somewhere between 3 and 5 years. So you constantly have these poor people who are perishing in the fields, and the supply had to be constantly replenished. Hamilton, despite the historic stereotype, turns out to have been the most consistent abolitionist among the founders, bar none. I repeat, bar none. So when you look at the early history of the Republic through the lens of slavery, not the only way to look at it, but I think a significant way, Hamilton begins to look a little bit more like the populist, and Jefferson and Madison, who owned 200 and 130 human beings respectively, begin to look a little more like the privileged aristocrats.
Indeed. And some would argue that Hamilton was the most ambitious of abolitionists. But it wasn't just blacks and the poor and the disenfranchised and the slaves who he had in his heart.
Hamilton, it also turns out, had very enlightened views about Native Americans. Many in this audience will know that there is a college in upstate New York called Hamilton College. Well, the origins of that school, it started out as a secondary school that was supposed to educate Native Americans. Hamilton lent his name and his prestige to that undertaking. Hamilton turns out to have had very benign and enlightened views about Jews. He said in an unpublished paper that the success of the Jews could only be explained by special providence. So here's this man whom we're taught to regard as this ferocious snob who again and again shows himself as not only devoid of prejudice, but with a special sympathy for the oppressed.
A special sympathy for the oppressed. And by the way, it makes perfect sense given his life background. And yet his appeal to the upper class and the appeal to making it that was there too. And this is not a contradiction, folks. You can do both. And he proved you could do both. So what about his role in helping form this little thing called our federal government?
Now, I think with the clear exception of George Washington, nobody did more than Alexander Hamilton to weld the 13 squabbling states into the powerful nation we know today. Hamilton personally drafts the first appeal for the Constitutional Convention. He attends it. He is the sole New York delegate to sign it. It is Hamilton who dreams up and then supervises the most influential defense of the document ever written, the Federalist Papers. Of those 85 essays, Hamilton manages to draft an astonishing 51. No less astonishing, there are periods where he's publishing them at a rate of as many as 5 or 6 per week. No less astonishing, he's doing it as a sideline. He had a full-time legal practice.
5 to 6 of the Federalist Papers a week as a sideline. And by the way, as you hear different people of different political persuasions talk about this achievement, bringing all the states and delegates together in Philadelphia, remember, conservatives should remember this, and Republicans, that the problem these men were trying to solve was actually bringing some consolidated power to Washington, D.C. Very difficult to wrap your heads around, but that was the case. We had 13 states with 13 different currencies. It wasn't working out, and there was no way to pay back war debt. So let's always remember, these guys had nuanced opinions. There were battles going on between Hamilton and Jefferson, the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists that we're going to learn about. We're still having these same discussions, folks, and these same arguments today, because they're timeless arguments. But without Alexander Hamilton, as Ron Chernow said, and without George Washington, there is no America. There's just no way around it. And he wasn't born here. So it turns out this young, precocious guy, this incredible reader, this incredible and prolific writer, well, he liked to speak and write a whole lot.
You could see where the laconic Jefferson was quite understandably terrified of Hamilton's sheer brilliance. Hamilton was one of these frightening windbags whom you meet from time to time who can speak in perfectly worded paragraphs for hours on end, and Hamilton did. Hamilton also was one of these intimidating characters who could and did toss off a 10,000-word opinion overnight for George Washington. And you could see in Jefferson's diary that he's really struggling with Hamilton. Quote, Hamilton made a speech of 3/4 of an hour in the cabinet today as if he had been speaking to a jury. The next day, Jefferson wearily records, Hamilton spoke again for 3/4 of an hour. Hamilton was, quite frankly, a word machine. Hamilton wrote enough in 49 years to fill 22,000 pages in the latest edition of his collected papers. And your speaker this evening, I confess, was masochistic enough to read every one of those pages. It is said that Harold Sirrett, who edited the papers for Columbia University Press, an outstanding job, Harold Sirrett evidently used to joke that he intended to dedicate the many volumes to Aaron Burr, quote, without whose cooperation this project would never have been completed.
Nothing like a good history joke to get the history crowd going. And you'll learn if you don't know why that joke's funny. Well, we're not going to tell you right now, but we will tell you in a bit. And this is Our American Stories. When we come back, we'll explain the other side of why that joke was funny, and much more. And by the way, to catch all of our This Days in History, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and go to the This Day in History section. We've got nearly 100 great stories about just about everything. More after these messages and the life of Alexander Hamilton. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And I just wanted to pick up on a point that we were talking about before, because it's one that I think so many of us don't really think about when we're reading history or thinking about history. And as always, again, our This Day in History segments are brought to us by Hillsdale College. And today we're talking about the life of Alexander Hamilton. He died this day in history, July 12, 1804. It's a point that David McCulloch makes in a great speech in Hillsdale College. I think we're going to play it one day soon because it's so important. He's talking to all these students, and they're asking him essentially, what's it like writing about history? What was it like studying these men? And he said, well, the first thing I want to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, is they didn't know they were making history. They weren't sitting around, he said, in their little white wigs going, oh, isn't it interesting, wearing these funny uniforms and these funny clothes and these wigs and getting ready for people to write stories about us. They were engaged in an epic struggle. They didn't know how the war was going to end. They didn't know whether there'd be a constitution. They had no idea what the outcome was going to be. And this is why I think we're bringing you Ron Chernow, because he actually manages, as he tells the story of Hamilton, to bring us right back there. And we don't know how it's going to end. I mean, we sort of do. We're living in America. We know it's a functioning democracy, I think. But then they didn't know, and they really didn't. And so we left you off with Ron Chernow at the New York Historical Society, one of the great institutions in the country, in Manhattan, talking about the life of Hamilton in 2004, because he had just dropped on the American public this great biography called Alexander Hamilton. And he dug into this speech a particular part of Hamilton's life. The Federalist Papers were written anonymously. And Chernow talks about the importance of anonymous speech for our founders, which surely caused folks like Thomas Jefferson real headaches.
Even as Treasury Secretary, we find Hamilton dabbling in anonymous journalism under a bewildering variety of Roman pseudonyms. Hamilton launched one series of essays under the guise of Camillus. This is while he's Treasury Secretary. And then a simultaneous series called Philo Camillus that extravagantly heaps praise on the brilliance of Camillus. When Hamilton publishes some article supporting Washington's neutrality proclamation, Jefferson contacted James Madison and pleaded with him to rebut Hamilton in print. Quote, "For God's sake, my dear sir, take up your pen, select the most striking heresies, and cut Hamilton to pieces. There is nobody else who can and will enter the lists with him. There is nobody else in America who could enter the lists with Alexander Hamilton." And as you'll see from the book, even James Madison often shrank from the invitation.
Wow. And James Madison was no lightweight. Jefferson wasn't either, but he was just way out of his league. Everyone was, as Chernow indicated. And by the way, just digging into that anonymous speech a bit more, you know, the Federalist Papers were published anonymously. And to this day, when you start to hear people question or ask who gave a donation to what or why, you always got to ask yourself why they're asking the question. Some people might just want to give to an organization anonymously for the precise reason that someone might be trying to punish them for that donation. And this anonymity in speech is a very rich tradition. Indeed, one of the worst cases in American history, the state of Alabama versus NAACP, some white donors had given money to the NAACP. The state of Alabama came in and said, "We want to know, NAACP, who gave that money." Now, the state of Alabama was up to no good. And thank goodness the Supreme Court upheld the anonymity of that donation. Because when the state's knocking on the door to try and figure out who you voted for or what you gave money to, no good could come of that. And here was Alexander Hamilton understanding that. And understanding, most importantly, it was the message that mattered, not the author. The message that mattered. Well, a little bit later, we get into, well, the really remarkable death of Alexander Hamilton, because he's obviously killed in a duel, and Burr does the killing. And, well, here's Burr on killing Hamilton.
Burr was never unduly disturbed by having killed Hamilton. He had a rather macabre sense of humor. He liked to refer jokingly, quote, to my friend Hamilton, whom I shot.
My friend Hamilton, whom I shot. And by the way, that happened in Weehawken, New Jersey, one town over from where my mom and dad met and ultimately got married. And that is literally a stone's throw away. You can just look across the Hudson River. These spectacular views. It's worth going through the Lincoln Tunnel, going into that particular part of Weehawken. There's a statue there. And you see the paces. You can see where these guys counted it off, turned around, and just shot at each other. Because, darn it, that's how men settled disputes back then. You can't even imagine it. And now when I hear, oh, my goodness, the political debates, they're just so hard. I go, oh, my goodness, read a little history. This is mild. We call each other some names, and then we go out to our press conferences and our gaggles and off to a really nice dinner on K Street. Here's how Ron Chernow ended things in this really remarkable story of his own book in 2004 at the New York Historical Society.
You have the entire early history of America wrapped up in this single personal drama. I would maintain that from Lexington and Concord in 1775 to at least Jefferson's first inauguration in 1801, nobody stood more consistently at the center of American political life than Alexander Hamilton. This is a story, an incredible story, of an illegitimate orphan young man who comes out of nowhere, sets the world on fire, and grows up quite literally alongside his adopted country. Thank you.
Quite a talk, and you can just Google that and find it, by the way, and so much more. Chernow did a tour around that time. He also did a remarkable piece on C-SPAN. Go into their archives, type it, and pretty soon on ouramericannetwork.org, we will actually start linking the direct links and pictures of the video. So you can just go on there, and if you don't want to hear us blabber on, you go straight to the source itself and listen to that. Either way, no harm here. We're happy to serve you either way. And this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And this is our This Day in History feature. And we're talking about the life of Alexander Hamilton, his story, his prolific life. And again, 51 of the 85 essays that form the Federalist Papers were written by him. And look at this biography again. Aide-de-camp to then General George Washington, the nation's first Treasury Secretary, the founder of the Federalist Party, our nation's financial system, the United States Coast Guard, and the New York Post, some think he created the first bond. And what could we have ever done in this country without that? And what was it? And what a financial genius. I wanted to leave with just one little thing. I'm reading 1776, and there's not much written in this book about Hamilton, but this little paragraph, which always caught my attention. It's about some battles, and here's what was written. Washington had reined in his horse and called off the pursuit. Another part of the army had entered the town where some 200 of the British garrison there had barricaded themselves inside the large stone main building of the cottage, Nassau Hall. When Captain Alexander Hamilton and his artillerymen fired a few rounds into the building, the redcoats gave up. He was also a warrior, folks, in the heart of war, fighting the British. When it mattered, with all on the line. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Today, we're spending the hour on Alexander Hamilton, and all of this is brought to you by our great partners and our sponsor at Hillsdale College, one of the finest colleges in this country and the only one that I think digs in the classical liberal arts tradition from the Western canon, the ancient Greeks, the ancient Romans, straight through the Bible, all the way to the founders, everything in between, literature, art, philosophy, and political theory as well. But that's last, not least. And you can go to hillsdale.edu and you can see all of their great online content, because you don't have to send a child to Hillsdale, though I would advise it if you would, because it is a remarkable place to send your child. They will come out the better for it and be well-prepared adults. But Hillsdale can come to you through their remarkable online courses. And I've been talking earlier about the remarkable play in New York City, the musical Hamilton. And we wanted to play a little bit of music from it. And here is Guns and Ships.
How does a ragtag volunteer army in need of a shower somehow defeat a global superpower? How do we emerge victorious from the quagmire, leave the battlefield waving Betsy Ross's flag higher? Yo, turns out we have a secret weapon, an immigrant you know and love who's unafraid to step in. He's constantly confusing, confounding the British henchmen. Everyone give it up for America's favorite fighting Frenchman! I'm taking this horse, man of reins, making red coats, weather with bloodstains. And I'm never gonna stop until I make a drop, I burn them up and scatter the remains down. Watch me engaging them, escaping them, and raising them out. I go to France for more fun, I come back with more guns and ships, and so their balance shifts.
We rendezvous with Rochambeau, consolidate their gifts.
We can end this war in Yorktown, cut them off at sea, but for this to succeed, there's someone else we need.
I know.
So he knows what to do in the trench, ingenuitive.
Those are the words of Lin-Manuel Miranda's musical Hamilton. He wrote the plot, music, lyrics, and even performs in it. I mean, it is stunning. And it makes you rethink rap. Whatever you might have thought about it, what was scat? Remember in the day when jazz scat artists were some of the most remarkable musicians? And I think he actually is trying to even save an art form itself. His rap didn't have to go the way it did, with sort of ghetto vulgarities. Didn't need to go that way.
Oh, Alexander Hamilton, I have soldiers that will yield for you. If we manage to get this right, they'll surrender my early life. The world will never be the same, Alexander.
Leah Labresca at 538.com, that's Nate Silver's blog, said this about the play. The use of rap helps Miranda pack more than 20,000 words into 2.5 hours, roughly 144 words per minute. If Hamilton were sung at the pace of other Broadway shows I looked at, it would take anywhere between 4 and 6 hours. She found that the musical's fastest paced verse from the song Guns and Ships clocked in at 6.3 words per second. So we wanted to dig into the archives here. And here's Ron Chernow, the author of Hamilton, talking about how he met Lin-Manuel Miranda. Let's take a listen.
They told me that Lin-Manuel had read my Hamilton book and made an enormous impression on him, and he wanted to meet me. So I went to a matinee of In the Heights one Sunday. And he invited me backstage, and I said to him, "So I gather my book made an impression on you." And he said, "Ron, as I was reading it on vacation in Mexico, and as I was reading it, hip-hop songs started rising off the page." So I said, "Really?" This is not a
that wasn't what you were going for?
This is not a typical reaction to one of my books. And he asked me on the spot to be the historical consultant. And so I said to him, "You mean you want me to tell you when something is wrong?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "I want historians to take this seriously," which I think they are.
Wow. So how did Miranda and Chernow work together?
that launched what has been an amazing six-year process working with him. And, you know, in the early period, we would have lunch and discuss Hamilton's psychology, relationships. He would send me via email every month one or two songs. I would just hear Lynn at the keyboard playing it. And but then what happened, once it started to go into various rehearsals and workshop productions, he would keep bringing me back in, and then I would have the opportunity afterwards to sit down for an hour or two and really give him my comments. And the comments, some of the comments were, if I thought something was factually incorrect, although I have to say he's very well read, and he was almost always aware when he was departing from the fact.
So even when he did depart from facts, it was just to merely advance a very condensed plot. You know, you're taking a man's whole life in a book that's hundreds and hundreds of pages, and you're condensing it into 2.5 hours of entertainment. So let's hear more about this really unusual partnership.
I think that there probably are a lot of historians and biographers who would not be entirely comfortable doing this because you have to have some flexibility in terms of the requirements of a show. I mean, here, you know, we were going from an 800-page book to a 2.5-hour musical, and my involvement with the show made me realize history is long, messy, and complicated.
Yes.
You know, if there's one thing that we all learn as historians is how difficult it is to generalize. The more you know, the more difficult it is to simplify some of this.
That's what I've been telling them in Mount Vernon. I've been there. Yeah.
But, you know, a 2.5-hour show has to be short and tight and, you know, very coherent.
Short, tight, and coherent it is. Chernow then tells us about why Miranda sometimes needed to change stories about Hamilton, change them around to make the musical work.
He would always have, I thought, a very plausible explanation of why he had changed something. I mean, I could just give you one, because it comes right at the beginning of the show, that the show begins right at the start of the American Revolution, and he has John Lawrence and Lafayette in New York a year or two before he actually, you know, meets them. So I said to him, Lynn, this is 1775, 1776, but they didn't, you know, meet Hamilton until 1777. But he wanted to, one of Hamilton's first friends when he came to New York was a tailor named Hercules Mulligan.
Yeah.
I think Lynn found the name irresistible. and Lynn wanted to start a series of quartets that run through the first act of Hamilton with his friends Mulligan, Lawrence, and Lafayette, which means that with Lawrence and Lafayette, he has to introduce them, you know, a little bit earlier than they appear. So, you know, there are moments where you have to scramble the time sequence a little bit. There are moments where you sort of have to collapse, you know, different events.
And so it goes. And here's a Broadway talent teaching an historian a little bit about his craft and his medium. And here, finally, is Ron Chernow on why folks are loving the musical Hamilton.
Lin-Manuel has done something extraordinary. He's made American history hip and cool and erudite at the same time. And only he could have done it. Because very, very often, without mentioning any specific examples, when people, you know, stage or screen, do the founding era, they kind of dumb it down. They seem to start out with the assumption that this is boring, dated stuff. No one's really interested in this stuff. So we better have a lot of action. We better have a lot of cannons, you know, booming and muskets, you know, firing. We better try to, you know, spice it up with some sex. But there's an underlying assumption that the contemporary audience is going to find boring. Lynn, instead of finding the history constraining, he finds the history liberating. He finds it exciting. And the more deeply he gets into the history, that the more dramatic it's going to be. And I think the audience feels that. So this is like the a history class of a lifetime.
And there you have it. And indeed, that play is hip, cool, and erudite. And I'm just waiting and hoping that we get more of these plays dramatized, these stories and life stories and history dramatized for Broadway and for the cinema. And for television, the Addams series was spectacular on HBO. You couldn't stop watching. And there's no reason that Washington's life and so many of these lives can't be dramatized and brought up to speed and made exciting, because these were exciting lives. And again, today we celebrate the life of Alexander Hamilton, who died on this day in history, July 12, 1804.